You're busy. We're very actually lucky today to have Trevor Stricker, who I met actually in the Boston Unity Group, he is a director of game development, title which you might all aspire to after some years, at Quick Hit Sports. It's a startup in this area. We'll talk a little bit about that. He says about himself that he's a veteran of over a decade of making video games. He has founded a major franchise, NBA 2K, founded a studio, Disco Pixel, and made quirky games in Japan, Smilebits. He has worked on every console from the Dreamcast to PS3, and he's currently making a free-to-play football game, Quick Hit NFL Football, at quickhit.com. And he says that it's an informal presentation, wants questions. He's here to kind of give you kind of advice from the trenches, is my sense of what's coming here. Thank you very much.
So, what I was going to talk about today are the things that I wish somebody had told me before I started making video games. I assume everybody here at least has some level of interest in making video games professionally. Just so I can kind of get a feel of who I'm speaking to. How many people want to be engineering or programming types? Cool. How many people are looking to be on the art side? Okay. Design?
Everybody raise your hand.
anybody interested in production? What about biz dev? Okay, a popular choice. So, rough overview of what I'm going to talk about. First of all, just some general development philosophy. Principles which kind of apply to wherever you happen to be, you know, whatever your role happens to be. I think a lot of these things sound like total common sense, but in reality, they're not followed that often in the real world. And so I think it's the kind of thing where if you keep in mind and then you're actually out there and making games, if you bring up some of these things, it might make you more valuable and it'll definitely influence the direction of the project that you're on. The other thing I wanted to talk about are career choices. I mean, you guys are going to be building careers. And there's a lot of things that were somebody had told me 15 years ago. And they're pretty simple things. And hopefully you guys will find that valuable. A bit about myself. So I'm at Quick Hit Sports. Has anybody played Quick Hit Football? Oh, awesome. Is anybody a football fan? Awesome. But I've been making games for 12 years, mostly console games, and I've made them on pretty much every console since the Dreamcast. Mostly AAA games, like Chuck mentioned, NBA 2K, Panzer Dragoon, if anybody ever played that, that was kind of an old school one. Fantastic Four, big movie license, big budget, all that rigmarole. I've been at large studios. Visual Concepts, which is a huge studio. Sega, which everybody's heard of. Smilebit, which is no longer around. I don't know if anybody's heard of it. I've also done indie startups, including Quick Hit, which I'm doing right now. Just a brief overview of the game that I'm making right now. I'm not going to talk too long about it. It's a browser-based free-to-play game. And just so you guys know, I'm sure most people here play games right now. And especially for somebody entering the industry right now, it's definitely worth paying attention to. You know, I talk to a lot of people and they just want to work on the Diablos or the Baldur's Gates of the world. And those are still definitely out there, but AAA game space has been in SQLite now for about 10 years, and that's, if anything, that's going to be cut, that's strengthening, as opposed to the free-to-play online game space. That's growing by leaps and bounds, and there's a lot of interesting things you can do with it. The game itself is a coaching strategy game, so it's not like Madden. You're not controlling the actual players, you're making the coaching level decisions. You're calling plays, you're training.
player. It's kind of like a football role. We serve about 40,000 games a day. So if those were all multiplayer, that would be 80,000 individual people playing a day. It's kind of a lot for a game like this. I know oftentimes you hear about numbers on Facebook, and those are millions or the tens of millions or even the hundreds of millions. But when they tell you they're monthly active users, that's really just the number of people who subscribe to their site, not actually use the game. We're kind of complicated from a technical perspective. We actually support two different clients.
There's a 2D Flash client, which you want because that's the biggest platform on the web. And we have a 3D Unity client, which you can sort of make out right here, which is cool, 3D rendering, looks gorgeous. We're also a licensed NFL game. So for those of you who aren't big sports game fans, there's a game called Madden, which is basically the biggest game in the world. And EA paid about $1.5 billion in 2004 to be the exclusive NFL game and take out all the competition. So a year ago, we landed an NFL license, and it's been pretty cool. So, I'm going to go over some development philosophy. Again, those seem like common sense, but sometimes common sense isn't so common. I really think that these are things that'll help you when you get started in the industry, especially when you start tackling your first problems. It'll give you a good mindset. And it'll also give you some ammunition to push back against the inevitable producers, schedule constraints, and even short-sighted thinking that's still very common. So the first thing, which I think should always be a mantra in game development, is you need to be able to iterate quickly on the game. Do you guys do projects? Like game projects?
Oh yeah.
Awesome. And so I'm sure you know that it can be a big pain in the butt where sometimes there's some value you want to tweak and it's buried deep in code and then you've got to rebuild the whole thing every time you want to change it. And on a personal game project where you're dealing with, I don't know, tens of source code files, that stinks, but it doesn't stink too bad. Now in a professional game project where you have different tiers and you might have different libraries that'll have to be linked together, your build time for just changing a single file can be 2 minutes for every single change you make. Now if you're trying to work out some kinks and some vector math where you know the football guy is running left when he should be running right, and you've got all sorts of signs that could be doing the right thing or could be doing the wrong thing, that's a real problem. Every single minute change you make, you know, you go through the code, you make your change, you click compile, and it takes 2 minutes. That's really going to cramp you. The same thing with designers. I mean, ideally, you want designers to be able to just make changes in real time and see the impact as they're playing the game. Now, that's not always possible. Obviously, if you're tweaking cameras, it's real easy to make real-time changes. If you're tweaking the level curve in a role-playing game, that's different because you know that's the kind of thing which might only be apparent after you're playing the game for 10 minutes or an hour. So the first thing I think is really important is the game's got to build quickly. And what does that mean? A single-click build. Now this sounds totally obvious, and it might not just be a single click. It might be you have to type make, but basically one step. You have no idea how many projects. There's one guy who's working on the tools, and there's one guy who's working on your physics library, which builds to a DLL that has to get linked in, and there's one guy who's working on the actual main loop of the game itself. And to get this whole thing building, you've got to go through and do all these different steps. And as a result, it just never happens. And so people are kind of working in their individual world, and you've got designers who are working on a build of the game that's a week or two old, and meanwhile, like something's radically changed, and then somebody tries to put everything together, and it just doesn't work. That happens a lot in real life. Continuous build. Are you guys familiar with the term? It goes by continuous integration or a bunch of different terms. What that means is, do you guys use source control, Subversion, SourceSafe, Perforce? Okay. So what that means is you have some server that every time somebody checks something in, does it get, and builds it to make sure that at the very least the build still works. And oftentimes there's the very most recent version for a designer group without even, or a non-technical person without even having to build it. That's really cool. And you can have it do all sorts of other things like unit tests. You know, you can write little programs that say, I want to make sure that my blocking logic still works, you know, so that when somebody goes and changes something under the hood in the vector math, all of a sudden, you know, your offensive line will be trying to walk backwards when they're trying to block, because that would kind of suck. And so you could write little programs that plug into it and execute these things, and if something bad happens, they can send you an email and say, hey, you broke blocking. The next thing that's important is fast tweaking. This is what I was mentioning before about designers really being able to make changes without being bottlenecked by a programmer. I'll get into this in a bit, but I mean, I'm sure all you guys here have worked in design on your projects. You've had the frustration of dealing with a programmer, like myself. And as you look at the guy sitting next to you, and you've been like, hey, can we have it do this? Can we have it do this? Can we have it do this? And meanwhile, the programmer's got his own things to worry about. He's like, you know, the models aren't building right now, or oh my God, you know, for some reason our frame rate dropped to 2 frames per second. And there's a designer here like, hey, can you just change this? Can you just change this? Think of how much better life would be if the designer could just make those changes without ever having to bother a programmer. You know, this sounds like common sense, but it just doesn't happen all that often. And again, if they can do it in real time, if they can just be tweaking some number in a file somewhere and it automatically updates the game, and then they can just save that file and commit that right to the build, that's really the gold standard. And ultimately, that helps you make a better game. I mean, really, the more time your designers can spend actually authoring the game and tweaking how things work, the better off everybody is. And the less hassle programmers are by a designer being like, do this. The last thing is a one-step deploy. It's kind of similar to a single-click build, but what that essentially means is you want a non-technical person, whether it's a producer, an artist, whoever, or a QA person, actually, most essentially, to be able to get a working version of your game, whatever that is. What I mean by whatever that is, you know, if you're working on a console game, they ought to be able to just put a disk in, type a command, or press a button, walk away, and then have that game burned on a disk, and however long it takes. Writing a web game, they ought to be able to, you know, click a button in a deploy script somewhere and then have it, you know, fully deployed to the whole stack without ever having to harass a programmer. Again, this sounds totally obvious, but in real life, it tends not to work that way. And you really want your QA people, for example, to be able to test the game, because oftentimes there's the way you think it's working, but that's not the way it's actually working. And you've got to enable your testers to be able to speak the truth to you. The next thing is do it right. And that means do it right the first time. So often you'll be designing a feature and you'll say, you know, we've got this milestone coming up and this feature isn't really, we only kind of need part of this feature for the milestone. There was a hack I put in NBA 2K, which came out in 1999, that has to do with where the refs look at the ball. And there's actually a comment above that that says E3 hack. And by E3 hack, that meant, you guys know E3, that meant it was a hack for the trade show in 1999, like 12 years ago. That hack is still in the code base. And you can actually see it if you play NBA 2K11, sometimes you'll see the ref. You know, they'll be like on the side, they'll be looking at the ball, and then their heads will turn around. That's my hack. Sometimes you got to push for it. You know, you'll have a producer saying, this is the deadline, we need to get it done. You'll have a designer saying, here's what I need just to get something done. And you've got to, you know, again, sometimes it neatly tears into a tier one and a tier two. But if it doesn't, part of the value of being a professional, and one thing you learn with experience, is that you've got to kind of manage the expectations of people around you. And part of that is pushing back when people ask you to do things that just aren't good for the game, aren't good for the project. You know, especially as a junior person, sometimes you can feel that there are all these conversations happening that you're not in the loop in, and it's kind of seen as a foregone conclusion that something's going to happen, and you're the guy with the information that knows it can't happen soon, and you're the only guy because you're the person who's actually implementing it. And it's actually very valuable to speak truth to power and to push for things that don't have the game going into a dead end. I think another thing that's really important is not to be trapped for ideals. Sometimes you think that there's a quote right way to do something because you've got a really elegant solution in your mind. But really, for the game that you're trying to build, it doesn't matter that much. You know, maybe you've got a really optimal pathfinding solution that's going to be great, that'll scale. But if you're making a football game, you know, you don't have mountains erupting in the middle of the field. So you don't need sophisticated real-time pathfinding. So, you know, sometimes you have to kind of pull back from your ideals, from the cool things that you want to implement, and understand that something simpler might not be as intellectually satisfying, but it might be good enough. So there are a lot of designers here. There are a lot of programmers here. There's some artists here. The classic conflict in video game development is you have a designer who wants the moon. And sometimes your job as a programmer is to tell him which streetlight he can climb on top of. And I think it's the same thing with artists. You know, oftentimes you have an artist, you know, Fantastic Four, we had a lot of aliens. Right, because you know they're in space and they're in space stations, and there's Dr. Doom with his cape, and we had an artist who made a Dr. Doom cape that was so gorgeous. And he's like, oh, you can animate the cloth, and it's got all these vertices, and look, he throws a fireball, and the cape just kind of folds off his arm, just so. Right, so he was rendering this all offline in Maya, and we were looking at this like this is never going to work in real time, but especially like with all these complicated subsurface scattered cloth shaders. So I think there's the possibility that can really lead to a lot of conflict where the programmers are like, what planet is this guy on? What is he thinking? And the artist is like, I just want to make the coolest cape possible. And you kind of want your artist to think that way. And you want your artist to be asking, or your designers to be asking for the moon. And I think the way you keep that constructive is make sure that it's a two-way conversation. Again, this sounds like total common sense, but I've been on so many teams where you've got designers that think programmers are complete jerks for restricting them so much. I think this has to be enabled on both sides. And you know, the simplest form, that's just going out to lunch with people and talking about the direction of the game. But I think there are certain things you can really do to kind of enable this. So I think great designers really work hard to understand the limitations to under the hood. Doesn't mean that they try and be constrained by it, but this is actually something that one of our designers asked for. 70,000 guys like playing a different animation or doing the wave. And, I mean, it sounds kind of cool, but it's not really serious. You know, we're not gonna, that'd be a very difficult thing to implement in real time and a very easy thing to fake. But I think designers learn, you know, good designers learn things like how data flows between systems, where the bottlenecks are. And I think it's incumbent on programmers to break things down logically, to articulate how things work, to articulate where the bottlenecks are, and to do it in a way that a non-technical person like a designer or an artist can understand. You know, not using phrases like enumerated constant. I think also it's incumbent on programmers to understand the overall vision of what it is that they're building. Programmers can often suggest additions because they know what's simple to do and what's adjacent to what the designer actually wants to do. And so when a designer asks for something like this, you know, if the designer's vision is he just wants the stadium to feel alive, well, the programmer can be like, you know, there's cool ways we can just fake it. You want them to do the wave? Well, there's easy ways to do that. Another thing, which I guess I didn't put up here, that's really important, is to play a lot of reference games. Nobody's making a game that's totally unique, and if you ever think you are, you should probably question that, because you shouldn't try and innovate on too many steps at once. And it can be very helpful when designers, we should be playing games all the time, obviously, when designers suggest reference games to people. You know, at our office, we play a lot of Madden, we play all the Facebook football games. And it's very useful for when a designer who's pressed for time and has to write all these documents for the artists, for the investors, for the producers, whoever, to just be able to be like, look, you know, you want to see how the quarterback rollout should work. Pick up NBA 2K4, play this team against this team, and watch how that happens. And that's kind of cool. Enabling creators. So this is a bit of what I was talking about before, that you want to let the creative people, the designers and the artists, author the game. And as programmers, you should sort of see it as just as important as building the actual game itself, is building tools to enable them to do that without you in the loop, as much as is reasonably possible. You know, so that sounds really obvious. What happens in practice? So I'm thinking about model viewers. So obviously artists need to be able to see the actual models and animations that they're working on in the actual games, because in a game on a TV, it's always going to be different than on a gorgeous artist perfectly calibrated monitor, right? So one thing you always want to keep in mind is you want to have a way for artists to view the assets that they're making. So what happened in NBA 2K? Well, you had an artist who'd be working in Maya, and he'd finish an iteration of a basketball player. So he'd save the file, he'd click export, and then he would wait. And then it would crash. So he'd click export again, and he would wait, and then it would export. He would copy the file over the network to the viewer machine. Then he'd get up from his desk and walk over to the viewer machine and start the viewer process on the dev kit. Then he'd see the gorgeous Microsoft Xbox logo animated. You know, remember the old Xbox one with the X that kind of peeled off with like a demon? So he looked at that logo a lot. Then it would spin up our viewer, and he would wait. Then it would give him a list of every model that was on that viewer machine. Let's say there were 500, and they were all in alphabetical order. And he would scroll through them with a D-pad. And let's say the model he was working on was called Zach. This is a painful process. And every time he wanted to do the very reasonable thing for an artist of seeing how his work would lurk in the actual game, he would have to do this. And then what he would discover is, oops, I made a mistake binding the mesh to the skeleton. Every time the guy raises his hand above his head, you know, big vertices pierce through his skull. Gotta redo this. So, you know, I guess sitting here on a crisp winter day in a beautiful classroom 10 years later, that sounds like the dumbest situation. How would aware professionals ever get into this situation? Well, how it works, you know, when you're starting off on the game, you've got a rendering programmer who's working on optimizing pixel shaders for just the right level of subsurface scattering, so that when you know the lights are behind a guy's ear, you know, you just see like just the corona of his ear. That looks really cool. You've got a tools programmer, and he's working on that exporter so that the artist can export his scene with as few crashes as possible out of Maya. You've got the artist who's heads down working on the model. And you, remember, artists don't just work on one model in console games, because typically they're making multiple levels of detail. That one model has to have 5, 6, 7, 8 different versions. And you know, he's heads down trying to get that done, because there's a producer who's got a schedule who's like, okay, we need X number of basketball models. How many are you going to get done this month? Let's go. And of course, art viewer, oh yeah, so somebody, you know, maybe a tools guy, maybe the rendering guy, whoever, in their spare time is like, okay, I made a art viewer, yeah, you just copy it on the hard drive with the dev kit, and you can look at any model you want. Any one of those 500 models. Done. Bam. Next. And, you know, initially it's not even that bad, but nobody ever really, you know, everybody's got their goals and everybody's got their tasks, and then eventually you end up in the situation where there's 500 models on that hard drive, and it's crunch time, and the artist is trying to do finishing touches on 10 different models, and each change he makes is that laborious process of exporting, going over the exporter. And really, if somebody had this in mind at the very start of the project, it would have been incrementally more work to say, how about you just type in the host name of the rendering machine, and it's just constantly running that process, and it just gets it over the network. It's not that much additional work. And that's, I guess, one of the things you learn with experience. So,
Trevor, I have a question about tools. As I'm a tools guy, Brandon, too. I'm in some kind of extreme position that, you know, they just never made a tool that they didn't, you know, they never made a tool that was a waste of energy, that was always worthwhile. That the error is always just to make too few tools. Have you ever seen somebody or ever had experience of making too many tools?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely the way it is, I think you're right, people definitely in the real world err on too few tools. But sometimes you have somebody who's making a, you know, something like for dialogue in RPGs, or, you know, we had a localization tool on Fantastic Four, and they get the functionality right, and then they're working on a beautiful GUI, they're ready in C#, and it starts up nice with a little splash screen, and it's got all these buttons, and the clipboard, you can cut and paste, and it works effortlessly, and wide characters, because that's obviously the perfect way to do it. Unicode support, and some you can get carried away, but I wouldn't be too worried about that. I mean, I really think the things you want to focus on are workflow and enabling these people to do what they need to do.
So workflow tools are almost always good investments.
Exactly. And they're the things you have to push for. Because we have a feature that goes in the game, right? We didn't ship Quick Hit with a camera editor, which this is right here. Somebody actually, though, had to sit down and spend a few weeks making that. And the benefit is, this is actually kind of cool right here, you know? This is an example of real-time tweaking where the designers can watch a play looping over and over. And what you can't see right here is there are all these valuable variables about the angular velocity of the camera or how quickly the focus interpolates. And they can tweak that, and as the play runs, they can actually see it changing in real time. And if you want your game to look good, obviously, I think everybody can agree that cameras are pretty critical to doing this. The way this started was there was a text file which was on a server somewhere. And the programmer who did it just had all these camera parameters, and expecting, I guess, the designer to just go through and be like, here's how quickly I want the camera to interpolate its target position. Here's how quickly I want its actual, you know, its look from position to interpolate. Here's how quickly I want it to turn. As though a programmer is just going to come up with this, or a designer is going to come up with this all in his mind. And this was actually the second tier, where after it was working, we got some time to sit down and actually make this system. This is all running in the Unity editor, which is a great tool for building little editors like this, and it works really well. And I guess to your point, one of the cool things about Unity itself is because it has this pretty cool editor where you can, you know, pause and adjust variables in real time, you don't have to do all the grunt work of working on the UI.
The GUI's all done, you're not tempted to do something fancy.
Exactly. No, it's not a very fancy UI. It's got all sorts of problems. Unity actually doesn't let you, when you tweak values in real time, when you stop the program, it resets all the changes you've made. You can do some jittery pokery under the hood to get around that, but it doesn't do that out of the box. But it's a pretty workable solution. So just some other examples of editors that we have on my current project. Commentator lines. So as you can imagine, I mean, everybody's seen a football game or a sports game. You know, you've got commentators. You actually have different commentators. Typically, there's one guy who's just doing the play-by-play saying, you know, he threw the ball up the middle or, you know, running the ball to the outside. And then you've got another guy who's a color guy who's like, you know, they really need to convert this down if they're going to stay in this game. Or, you know, they shouldn't have lost that many yards on that play to kind of give color for how the team is doing. Now this is a pretty complicated system because there's lots of different things you can say in those situations and there's lots of different variables. So we actually have a really cool commentary editor where they can just go through and specify all the situations with different lines of play, and it's purely data driven. Programmer's not in the loop at all. That's really cool. So does anything sound more obvious than this? Do you know how many programmers get totally burnt out and never play games after a year or two in the industry? Never mind playing their own game. So I think in practice, the first thing is there should be a functional game as early as possible. Now, when you start off in a game project and there's, you know, beautiful green fields and there's nothing that you can't do, you're trying to put together your schedule, you know, block out some rough milestones. Oftentimes your first milestones are, you know, we want to get a cool animating guy. We want to work on our rendering. We want to make it shiny. And sometimes your first milestone is first playable. We're going to have a really simple fight move and you can play against a really simple enemy. And I think that's just so much more valuable because ultimately, making games, not making movies. So at Quick Hit, we actually, our first playable was you could call a single offensive play, which was the halfback running up the middle, against a single defensive play, which was a cover two, and that was it. You couldn't score, couldn't actually move the line of scrimmage, there were no downs. You could just call those two plays over and over and over and over. But it was a game, and it was pretty amusing for a minute or two to sit there against people in the office and, you know, see who could get the most yards. But only for a few minutes. The other thing is you should keep the game functional. So oftentimes when you're adding big new features, you kind of have to make changes all over the code, and that can break things. A better way to do that, nowadays we don't use version control, nobody just edits files on a hard drive anymore, is you can typically make a branch, make all your changes in that branch, and then merge those changes back into your main development trunk. It's really bad if you ever break the game. Oftentimes it's done when, you know, a big important programmer wants to add some big important feature, and then they're, you know, they've got to change the client and the server, so they'll be going in there. making these changes. And the problem is, then you get into a situation where your designers can't use the most recent build. And somebody inevitably doesn't get a version of the game that's broken, then you gotta waste all this time trying to find out which previous version of the game was the last functional one. And it's just a big waste of time. The other most obvious thing is you should play. You should play your game all the time, even when it's not fun, even when it sucks, and when it's really early. You know, besides the fact that it lets you see how the game actually is, instead of, you know, oftentimes when your head's down and you're working, you kind of see a small corner of the universe, and you don't understand that things aren't really working the way you, you know, there's the way you think it's working, the way you've designed it to work, and then there's the way it's actually working. And you kind of want to be aware of how it's actually working. Also, it helps you feel the pain of your players. Like any online game, we have a rabid fan base that loves us and hates us. And it's only by actually playing the game a lot that we see, you know, that a lot of the times when people are complaining about something, they've got a point, and we've got to go in there and fix it. We just had our big tournament at work. Besides the fact that it was a lot of fun, our office was really buzzing when we had an artist from England, not a big football country, in our sense of the word, and he was beating a Massachusetts-born Patriot fanatic. Everybody's around their desk. It's pretty fun. It got one of our web programmers, who's a girl, not much into football, not much into sports in general, trying to figure out the differences between the different outside running plays, so she could do a little better in her next office tournament. And also, just to be honest, the finals were a really great reason to bring a few cases of beer into the office. So that's that. Now I want to lather on a bit as an old man about some things career-wise that I wish people had told me before I was actually out working. So making games professionally can really be an awesome thing. I mean, you're making pop culture. Sometimes you go to your friend's house and you pop open his Xbox and there's your game. People like who find out you've worked on games, like they're always like, can I see your name in the credits? That's kind of cool. I've been doing this for more than 10 years. I still have a hard time believing somebody pays me to do this. But on the other hand, making games can leave you burned out, can leave you miserable and hating the world. You can get stuck in mediocrity working on wood crates for a game that nobody will ever hear of. So, if you're ambitious, here are some things that I think can help you meet your goals. First thing is to have goals. Seriously, have concrete goals. Know what you want to do. There's really a lot of things out there that you can do, but you kind of have to know what you want to do. I mean, do you want to be a design director? Do you want to start a company? Do you want to work on cutting-edge rendering? You kind of have to know these things. So, first thing I think is important is that as you progress through your career, this isn't just games, this is really anything. Oftentimes, you have to make the choice whether you want to get more heavily into having really deep domain knowledge about something. You know, whether you want to be the rendering ninja, whether you want to be the AI expert, or whether you want to be more of a manager, you know, whether you want to be a lead programmer or a design director. They're kind of different paths, and it's something you know, only you really know what you'll be the best at. When you manage people, on one hand, it's kind of cool because you know, you get to talk to a lot of people, and on the other hand, it can be miserable because everybody's problems become your problems. And especially in a large team, you feel like herding cats sometimes. When you've accumulated a lot of knowledge on the subject, it's cool because you get to be an expert. You can do all sorts of things. You can contract yourself out. You can have a really cush job at a big company. But you're also the guy who gets called in the middle of the night when the servers aren't rebooting and nobody knows why. Sorry, somebody asked something.
No, I've seen that happen.
Oh, yeah. I think another thing to kind of see your career as is a series of steps. You want to know where you want to go. You only get so many steps to make, and there's going to be plenty of problems that are outside of your control that'll set you back. you want to make sure that each step you take gets you closer to that goal. And you don't want to waste steps. You know, everything you do is a risk. Not everything you do will work out. But oftentimes, the experience you get is more valuable than, you know, the financial remuneration. Mark Pincus, the guy who founded Zynga, certainly founded a lot of failed companies before he started Zynga. It's also worth thinking about life-work balance. Ultimately, I think you want to work really hard, but you've also got to make time for important things like, you know, family and traveling and doing crazy things. I think you should write down your goals. Maybe it's just me, but I'm pretty serious about that. If anything, it helps you be honest with yourself. You don't have to show them to anybody. Sure, you can change them, but you know, really the most important thing you can know is kind of just have self-awareness to know what you're good at and what you're really interested in. And you see it not just in video games, but really in anything where, you know, there are certain people who are still involved and excited and interested in what they do 30, 40 years out, and there are some people who are just collecting a paycheck and waiting until they can retire. And who wants to be miserable like that? So this is something that I think is extremely important. Even nowadays when you know, you can be very tempted out of college just you'll take a job, you're looking for a job. But I think you really have to pick your job really well. So the first thing is you want to pick a studio with ambition. There's tons of studios out there cranking out ports, especially in the age of huge mega publishers. You know, there's the studios that are actually doing the real work for the studio or for the publisher. There's the studios making the original IP, making the interesting games. And then after they do the important work, the publishers kind of have their second-rater studios where they're like, yeah, you can make the, you know, PS2 port of this 360 game. If you're ambitious, you have a studio with ambition. So you definitely want to work at a place that's actually making compelling games. I mean, if you don't love it, why will your players? And if you end up at one of those studios that's just grinding out ports, well, it'll grind through you too. To be honest, you could spend decades laboring away in obscurity. And you don't want to get started down that path. You also obviously want to pick a studio where the people have a history of success. You know, when studios start up, there are people who leave really established studios, like I'm thinking, have any of you guys heard of Left 4 Dead? Right? So it started by Didier Malenfant, who was at Sony Santa Monica. I think he was on the God of War. I can't remember. But you know, he left, and now they've been around for a while. Do you guys have friends there? Is that around California? There was a chuckle. You want a stable position. Nobody ever told me this. Behind the scenes, when you're talking to a company, there's all sorts of stuff happening. And you want to make sure that the person who's bringing you on, the hiring manager, is secure in the company. The project he's bringing you on has the backing of the studio behind it. And this is really, really important. Nobody ever told me this. So I guess as an example, there was a studio in San Francisco where I had some buddies at. They were making, I don't want to mention the studio, but they were working on some fairly large IP. 360 PS3. This is about 2007, so that was, I mean, it was a pretty premier developer. And there was a guy there who was in management who really wanted to spin up some DS projects, because, you know, the DS was a really interesting platform at the time. And he thought this would be totally fascinating. And they had some extra resources, he had some spare time. So, and he had an idea of a game he wanted to make. So he hired a programmer who was a pretty junior guy. It was actually his second job in the industry. This junior guy was really psyched because, you know, he was sold on the fact that he'd be like the main guy on this project. It was going to be his deal, and it was going to grow, and they were going to give him some artists, and after it was past a certain point, they were going to give him more programmers, and he was like, wow, what a stellar opportunity. Well, you know what happened? As the studio's main project, as their next-gen project, near completion, they were running behind schedule. Very common story in video games. They started pulling any extra resources from anywhere in the company to devote to the thing that was actually paying the bills. Their publisher, which is a large publisher, was like, why are you guys wasting money on this DS project? Why are you wasting your time on this? So the guy who was in management, who had lots of options because he was a pretty senior guy, he peaced out. He's like, whatever, I'm going to go work for EA or somewhere else. He had options. What happened to the guy who was the programmer on the DS? He got kind of screwed. I mean, he kind of drifted from project to project, you know, passed around like stale pizza. He was pretty miserable, and he ended up leaving after a year. And, you know, he ended up getting the axe, and he just kind of floundered, wasted a year. Now, you guys kind of want to avoid that situation. So how can you avoid that? There are things you need to ask. What are these things? Well, you really have to feel out the situation. What could this guy have asked? First of all, he could have asked if the project itself had funding. Seems like an obvious question. But what they would have said is, no, once it reaches this point, then our publishers told us they're this is really interesting. Well, have they actually told you that? Have they made any promises? Or is it just you spoke to a guy at the publisher who was like, sure, yes, sounds interesting. Anyways, let's do the real work here. You could have asked how long, if it had funding, how long the funding would last for, assuming it didn't get picked up. You know, is he going to be in a secure project for a year? Or is it just kind of surviving in the cracks? He could have asked what the schedule to ship was, because if you're ever starting on a project that's completely open-ended, unless the studio is Valve or id, that doesn't really happen. And I mean, I'm serious. I mean, even Blizzard, who's a pretty successful studio, will cancel projects that they think are going on too long. StarCraft goes. And the nice thing about a schedule is it's a concrete thing you can ask for that they can't really give you the runaround on. You could also have talked not just to the hiring manager, the project lead, you could talk to his boss. Now, does that seem weird? I mean, being interviewed by somebody to ask to talk to his boss, the boss's boss, essentially? To be honest, no. I mean, you know, you've got to have enough self-respect and understanding your time is valuable. It's a totally reasonable thing to ask for. And if they push back and say, no, he's busy, you know, he's not interested in talking to you, that's kind of a bad sign. Ultimately, you want to, you know, be somewhere where you're going to, you know, be somewhere for a while where you're going to learn a lot. And that's not the way you treat somebody with respect. I think especially at the outset, you really want to find a mentor. Probably this is going to be the person who hires you. I mean, you got to think, do you have a good rapport with them? Do they have stuff they can teach you? Are they good at explaining things to you? You know, when it comes to picking the right opportunity, I think you really got to think about it as you're interviewing the company as much as they're interviewing you. Just a few more small things. First of all, everything is always changing. So expect it. You don't want to end up a dinosaur, you know, with some limited knowledge. Something that's really not that worthwhile. You know, I was talking about how the whole world used to be consoles and PCs, and you know, or if you ask somebody 10 years ago, what's the rate of change in games, they'll be like, graphics cards are getting better, processors are getting quicker, there's all this stuff we can do, right? New consoles used to come out every 5 years. There was the Sega Saturn, and there was the PlayStation, and there was the PlayStation 2, and there was the PlayStation 3. Well, notice the current crop of consoles is 7 years old. The new generation is not even on the horizon. Why? It's because there's so much, the marginal returns of faster is diminishing, and meanwhile, the revolution is free to play. It's not even better graphics. You know, Farmville graphics are good enough. Now, even on the technology side, sometimes, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So eons ago on a cartridge, your memory was really limited. So you compressed things, so you fit much on there, right? So then CDs came around, wow, mind-blowing storage. DVDs came around, holy cow, what could ever be bigger than this? Blu-rays. But now you actually compress things even more than on a cartridge. But why? You have like tens of gigabytes, this is huge. You put all of Google on that. Well, it's because Blu-rays are so slow. It's like, you know, you go to like the Dunkin' Donuts sometimes, and the guy's got to think, oh, you want this kind of coffee? So the bandwidth from Blu-ray is so slow that you have to compress just so you can load enough stuff into memory, unless you want to sit there for 10 minutes while your game loads. You really want to be a sponge for knowledge. You know, dive in, learn matrix math, start programming shaders, understand how multiple cores work. Asymmetrical cores, well, that's what the PS3 has. I mean, the more you know, the better. Yeah. Cool. Any questions?
Yeah. So you mentioned about goals and like knowing what you want to do. How would you go about like as a student leaving college, like determining what you want to do? Like if you have a wide range of interests, like how do you narrow it down to like how to be like this type of artist? Or, like,
first of all, you just do it. You know, the cool thing about right now is there's never been more time. There's never been like a better time for making games because you can, you know, the same tools that we use to make our game in Unity, you can download for free. Just check it out. You can download the personal learner's edition of Maya and play around with 3D art. If you make a game that doesn't suck, you can put it up on the web for free and put it in front of people. It's pretty awesome. So, I mean, I think if you want to do this professionally, you should certainly be doing it in your free time, and you know, you can play around with it. I think the other thing you can do is just ask a lot of questions. The cool thing about being in a program like you guys are in is you must know recent alumni who are, you know, working out in the world, and you know, you could just ask them, like, what is this guy? What is this guy? It's a totally reasonable thing to find out. Anybody else? Yeah.
I keep hearing around on the idea of finding a mentor for your career and stuff like that, but I never really hear what that looks like. Like, what does it look like to have a mentor for yourself?
Sure. I mean, I think the thing is, it sounds really cheesy and cliched, but it's cliched because it kind of stood the test of time. It's really kind of a free-form thing. It's not like a formal relationship. Basically, it's somebody who's been doing this a long time, who you have an opportunity to work directly with, who you can learn from. You know, I still talk pretty regularly to some of the guys at Visual Concepts where I first started making games. And, you know, sometimes it's just straight up information sharing. Like, they made football games, NFL 2K, which were pretty popular. I'm making a football game, and I can call them up just for banal questions like, how did you put the numbers on the back of the uniforms? Texture? Is it a shader? Was it? But also, you know, it's not just that those details, which honestly I probably could have Googled it and figured out a cool way to do it. it's also the more like meta knowledge, like, you know, what makes a good opportunity? What, you know, calibrating your bullshit filters, because there's a lot of bullshit in this industry. So, I don't know if that helps, if it was just bloviation, but anybody else?
I got a question about Quick Hit.
Yeah.
You guys have shipped this game, it's complete. Like, you said you get questions a lot, or issues a lot from fans about, like, oh, can you fix this, can you fix this? How many of those do you actually go in and fix the game for? And then, like, what do you guys do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, ideally, 100%. Mm-hmm. The problem with forums, everybody's been honest, right? Is the signal-to-noise ratio is awful. There's tons of trolls. So people will lose a game, or they'll lose a lot of games, they'll be on the far out. Your pass defense sucks, this guy couldn't block, and then we'll go look at his team, and so we actually have customer service people who will go and be like, well, the reason your pass defense sucks is because you haven't leveled up your linebackers, dude. So your secondary sucks. The game is not broken. But we also have people reporting crash bugs and hangs. Problem with an internet game is we have people reporting that the game hangs and they can't get into a game, and it's because they've got an ad blocker, right? It's like, how could I control your ad blocker? But we have to know these issues. So we take them all pretty seriously. not everybody's a troll. We have some users who are pretty dedicated who will actually help us debug these things, because what you see in the wild is totally different from what you see when you're in your office with your high-end plan, your high-end Macintoshes. And so a lot of it's just reaching out to your community, talking to people. We get them to do all sorts of things like run VxDiag on their systems, install debug versions of Flash players. That's how we get around that. Yeah.
What studio was this that had your friends go on a dead end project?
I don't want to say anything bad about them. I think it's more like an example to illustrate one of the bad things that can happen. This wasn't even a bad studio. This is just, he got caught between the cracks. And I guess the point is, you don't want to get caught between the cracks of huge corporations and imagination. Yeah?
What kinds of statistics do you keep about your game? Like, keep it balanced? Like, do you keep track of, like, the way games go, which teams are good or bad? Or?
We keep some statistics on that. The way we actually balance it is we have a tool which our designers use, which runs millions of simulations. So the designer can go through two things. And the way an AI simulation works is it's chaotic, because if you want to, like, just the other day we had a problem, if you go to our forums now, people are up in arms because we released an update and sacks were way too common. So sacks are like, quarterback is happening, he's trying to pass. And we're like, well, we didn't change any of that. We didn't make the blocking any more or less effective. We didn't make tackling any more or less effective. So the way we get around that is we have something which goes through and runs millions of simulations. We have more than 200 offensive plays, more than 100 defensive plays. It's a lot of combinations. It'll go through for each combination, run a lot of them, and then report overall statistics that our designers can use to change these variables. So that's how we catch problems like the sack bug. Now, problem is, we so rarely find problems at this stage that we got a little too comfortable. We had a strong push to, with a deadline, get this thing out the door. So, you know, we didn't properly QA it before it went out. And it turned out the problem was we changed a pass animation where it would take half a second longer, and that made the sacks basically 10 times more likely. So, you know, this is a case where, because we're out on the forums and paying attention to people, you know, at first, we were like, that guy's a troll, who cares what he says? His team probably sucks. But then everybody was saying it, and so, you know, 30 minutes later, we looked into it, and we ran that millions of simulations thing, and we're like, we have a problem. So we fixed it yesterday.
Yeah. How many people work at your studio?
Right now, we're about 35 total.
Are you looking for interns?
I mean, the problem is, you know, we're a startup, And when you're a startup that doesn't make money, you know, your VCs don't like it very much if you bring on a lot of extra people. I mean, I suppose we're always looking for unpaid interns, especially people who are chomping at the bit. But unfortunately, we don't have room for any, you know, proper paid internships right now. Yeah?
Do you have a lot of evil microtransactions in your game?
Absolutely. So, here's the thing. You gotta get paid somehow, right?
Well, yeah.
This is the business of making games. And microtransactions don't have to be evil. Advertising doesn't have to be evil. You know?
Trying to get like 800 bucks out of people by doing like
smurfers. So, you know, you can kind of see right there, there's an ad above the screen. I mean, what's wrong with that? You can actually pay to get rid of that ad. That's kind of cool. Now, I think one way that, because free-to-play games are so new, there are a lot of cheesy things happening right now. But it's, you know, it's maturing pretty quickly. We have guys like Brian Reynolds, who's a pretty hardcore designer going at Zynga. They're definitely trying to do the right thing, trying to give people value for their money. You know, some things in free-to-play games may be really cheesy, but, you know, it wouldn't be there if people weren't paying for it. There's so many hundreds of millions of people out there. We can't twist all of their arms.